listening to the radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 2 Samuel. Please open your Bibles to the book of 2 Samuel. Let's join Pastor Sandy as he teaches through chapters 11 through 13.
Scottish judge Francis Jeffrey was once quoted as saying, "A good name is got by many actions and lost by one." My mom preached the same sermon over and over to my brother and I. She said it this way, "Boys, it takes a lifetime to gain a good reputation, but only one night to tear it down." Oh, if David had heeded these warnings, if he had listened to his mama, one night of pleasure cost King David, the king of Israel, decades of distress. The nightmare begins in chapter 11. It happened in the spring of the year at the time when kings go out to battle. After being cooped up all winter, all kings needed a good fight, a good battle or two to get the juices flowing again and shake the cabin fever. But King David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. David just decided to sit this battle out. David goes on spring break. For 17 years, David has ridden a string of unprecedented military successes. He has had the Midas touch militarily. Every battle his army has fought, he's won. Hey, David has been working hard. Why shouldn't he take a vacation? Why wouldn't he need a little R&R? Oh, relax, Dave. Drop your guard. Chill. Enjoy the fruits of your labor for a change. That's the strategy he took. But then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. The Bible doesn't address why Bathsheba was on the roof of her Jerusalem condo in full view of the king's palace, taking a bath in the buff. Obviously, she shares some culpability in what follows. But the truth remains, if David had been doing what God had called him to do, this incident would have never taken place. It's been said, the devil tempts all men, but idle men tempt the devil. We certainly all need downtime, but only to refresh our upward look. It's one thing to take a break, it's another thing to take a break from God. And apparently that's what David did. You can be sure that Satan never takes a vacation. Always be on your guard. And I'm sure David rationalized, "Oh my, she is so beautiful. Oh, I wonder if she looks even prettier up close. We can just chit-chat. You know, have a cup of Starbucks. We can just pray together, her and I. As a matter of fact, I can lead her to the Lord. Hey, I think it's God's will that we get together tonight." You see, it wasn't the look that brought David down. It's what took place afterwards. The look was innocent enough. The surge of manly feelings that rushed over him, that was normal. But David failed to control those thoughts and harness those desires. You know, it seems controlling one's thought life is becoming a lost art today. We're still moral enough people to frown on certain actions. But we think it's okay to indulge our minds in any fantasy we choose. Hey, God is concerned not just about what we do, but about what we think. In fact, more so is that true. God knows our thoughts will eventually determine our behavior. We need to guard our thoughts. Proverbs 23, verse 7 applies to us all, "For as he thinks in his heart, so is he." It's been said promiscuity begins in the head long before it ends in the bed. I heard of a man who worked in an office full of gorgeous women. He said he kept a nail in his pocket. One day a friend asked him, he said, "Why in the world are you carrying around a nail?" And this was his answer: "I've learned a lot from a nail. Its head keeps it from going too far." Some of us men need to keep a nail in our pocket. Our head, good thinking, controlling our thoughts will keep us from going too far. It might have helped if David had reached in his pocket and grabbed a nail, but that's not what he grabs. He grabs this woman. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And you can imagine the rationalizations that started spinning through his head. J. Allen Peterson, he writes this: "There is nothing wrong with happening to see a beautiful woman bathing. Nothing wrong with recognizing her God-given physical attractiveness and charm. Nothing wrong with an involuntary rapid pulse beat, a surge of red-blooded manhood, an inner whisper, wow. But now the struggle begins. The struggle with his fantasies, his flesh, his faith, and his future." And someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" David should have backed off right there. Then David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity, and she returned to her house. David has committed adultery with another man's wife. It is a deed not even the king can undo. Its consequences now are going to haunt him forever. F.B. Meyer, he writes this in his biography on David. He says, "One brief spell of passionate indulgence, and then his character blasted irretrievably. His peace vanished. The foundations of his kingdom imperiled. The Lord displeased, and great occasion given to his enemies to blaspheme." One moment of indiscretion can topple a lifetime of achievement. David's momentary fling will shape the rest of his life. And of course, that's not what David thinks. For he assumes that come morning light, all will be forgotten. Life will be back to normal. Verse 5 proves otherwise. "And the woman conceived, so she sent and told David and said, 'I am with child.'" Now David has a real problem on his hands. And he has a choice he has to make. Will the king cover up, or will he confess? Can he admit his sin, or will he plot his cover-up? You know, I read recently about a new product on the market. It's called Audio Ally. Audio Ally. And for $9, you can buy a CD with various background noises. A dentist office, an automobile garage, an airport, 9 noises in all. So you can play this CD when you call your employer and tell him that you're not going to come into work that day. The noises substantiate the lie that you tell. "Well, boss, I'm fogged in Chicago. You know, I won't be back until tomorrow," while the noise is playing in the background. It's amazing the extremes to which we'll go, to which a proud person will go to cover up their sin. And nowhere is this better illustrated than in the life of David. The king commits adultery, but then he adds to it deception, betrayal, and eventually murder. Here's how despicable David's been. Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, is a soldier on the front lines. He's in combat for the king that has been seducing his wife. When David realizes Uriah is under his command, he sees a possible out. Then David sent to Joab saying, "Send me Uriah." And Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah had come to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war prospered. Now, obviously, none of this chit-chat really mattered to David. His concern was not the battle, but this baby in Bathsheba's womb. A child was undeniable proof of his adultery. He had a legitimate child. And the easiest way to solve his problem was to make Uriah think that Bathsheba's baby was his son. And so David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. In other words, sleep with your wife tonight. Sleep in your own bed tonight, Uriah. Cuddle up with your wife tonight. You've been fighting on the front lines. You deserve a break today. So go home and get away. Have a pleasurable night with your wife tonight. And I'm sure Bathsheba did her part. She had been coached what to do and all. When David saw her naked, he couldn't resist. He figures Uriah won't be able to resist either. What he doesn't figure on is Uriah being a better man than he. 9 months later, everyone but he and Bathsheba will think that this baby belongs to Uriah, or that's what his plan. So Uriah departed from the king's house, and a gift of food from the king followed. I mean, David even sends the honeymoon couple room service. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all of the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. So when they told David, saying, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, did you not come from a journey? Why did you not go to, man, what's up with you? You're crazy. And Uriah said to David, the ark in Israel and Judah are dwelling in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. What a noble attitude. Uriah's a better man than David. And boy, how his words must have stung the king's conscience. He's basically saying, how can I lay with my foxy wife while the troops are still in foxholes? I'm not going to enjoy the heat of passion while my friends are in the heat of battle. Verse 12 tells us, then David said to Uriah, wait here today also, and tomorrow I will let you depart. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now when David called him, he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. Now, this is David, the man after God's own heart, trying to compromise Uriah with booze. David's trying to make him, to loosen him up a bit, you know, to make sure that he goes down to his wife this night. He's trying to give him plenty of the king's wine to loosen him up and all. And at evening, he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. Even while drunk as a skunk, Uriah still had more integrity than David. Even after he was loaded, he stayed devoted to his troops. Uriah spends a second night with his men, not with Bathsheba. Well, in the morning it happened that David, it's getting serious now, it's getting desperate. He wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah, by his own hand. And he wrote in the letter saying, set Uriah in the front hand of the hottest battle and retreat from him that he may be struck down and die. He is so calloused. He forces Uriah to hand deliver his own death sentence. And so it was, while Joab besieged the city, that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew there were valiant men. In other words, the opposition were sharpshooters. And the men in the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite died also. It's sad what happens to him. He's in this fierce fight. Everyone around him suddenly withdraws on order but him. He's standing there alone with no support, with no cover. He's toast. He dies in the battle. Then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war and charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling the matters of the war to the king, if it happens that the king's wrath rises and he says to you, why did you approach so near to the city when you fought? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? In other words, Joab's admitting that his tactics were very poor battle strategy. David would recognize this. As a matter of fact, there was even a precedent, he mentions, who struck Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal-Sheth. Was it not a woman who cast a piece of millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? I mean, that's why you don't get close to the wall. Somebody might throw a millstone on top of you. The death of Abimelech was discussed back in Judges 9. See, Joab is worried that he might get blamed for military malpractice here. The general's job is to safeguard his troops, to prep his warriors. This is why he tells his servant in advance, when David asks you, why did you go near the wall? Then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Understand the impact David's murder of Uriah had on General Joab. Recall, David had rebuked Joab earlier when he killed Abner. Now the king has done a worse deed. There were reasons to view Abner with suspicion. Uriah, he's nothing but an innocent man. Joab sees the hypocrisy of what David's done. Later, he will lose all respect for David, and I believe the erosion of admiration and honor must have began right here. F.B. Meyer imagines Joab thinking, this master of mine can sing his psalms with the best, but when he wants a piece of dirty work done, he must come to me. Verse 22. So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent by him. And the messenger said to David, surely the men prevailed against us and came out to us in the field. Then we drove them back as far as the entrance of the gate. The archer shot from the wall at your servants, and some of the king's servants are dead. And your servant, Uriah the Hittite, is dead also. Then David said to the messenger, thus you shall say to Joab, oh, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it, so encourage him. Oh, in other words, don't worry. Accidents will happen. Oh, every war has its casualties. Outwardly, David is so glib about Uriah's death. Underneath, he's jumping for joy. His plan seems to have worked. Well, when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And notice God doesn't call her by name. Notice he doesn't call her Bathsheba. It's the wife of Uriah. God is accentuating the adultery that has occurred. You know, what started out a forbidden look, just a peek through the palm branches, now has ended up in the murder of a good man. And when her mourning was over, how long she mourned, she did her thing. She wore her black dress and she shed some crocodile tears. How long it all went on, we don't know. But it must have been quickly. It would have created questions unless a 9-month pregnancy had ended if they had just been married, 6 months or 3 months. So they must have got on with it very quickly, after the death of Uriah. So David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. And I'm sure David thought that now he can rest easy. The whole sordid mess has been swept under the rug. It's over now. We can move on. We can live life happily ever after. But Uriah is not the only person who fails to cooperate with David's ruse. For the last line rings out, but the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Boy, you can pull the wool over your own eyes. You can certainly pull the wool over your pastor's eyes and your friend's eyes and your children's eyes. You can pull the wool over even your own spouse's eyes. But you know what? The Lord sees you. You can't fool the Lord. He sees you. He knows what you're doing. Luke 12, verse 2 tells us, there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden that will not be known. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Now, chapter 12 takes place about a year later. Bathsheba is now queen. A baby has been born. David is on the throne, but the king is far from a happy camper. For this previous year has been the worst year of his life. His conscience has tormented him. The shame, the guilt for what he's done, the conviction has driven him to the brink of insanity. His secret sin has formed a cloud that has blocked out the rays of light of God's love and God's light in his life. As a matter of fact, David wrote of his experience during this year in Psalm 32, verses 2 and 3. He writes this, "When I kept silent, my bones grew old, though my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer." In verse 1, the Lord deals with David. Then the Lord sent Nathan to David. Nathan was a prophet of God. Some people believe he authored 2 Samuel. And he came to him and said to him, "There were two men in one city, one rich man and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb which he had bought and nourished. And it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom. And it was like a daughter to him." I mean, this little lamb was more cherished than a household pet. "And a traveler came to the rich man who refused to take from his own flock," you know, though he had many, many sheep, "and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him." Just took the precious little lamb from the poor man, and while there's plenty of lambs out in his own field. And so David's anger was greatly aroused against the man. And he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die, and he shall restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing and because he had no pity." This is an atrocity. This is hideous. No such act of avarice and malicious cruelty is going to be excused in my kingdom. The perpetrator will be punished. David's words also prove that he knew his Bible. For in Exodus chapter 22, verse 1, it says, "If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep." That's why David wanted the man restored fourfold. David knew his Bible, and yet David is proof that just knowing your Bible doesn't guarantee purity of heart. It doesn't guarantee a sincere heart. Just knowing the word doesn't mean that you're walking with God. Verse 7, "Then Nathan said to David," and though we're not told this, I picture the prophet seething with righteous anger, suddenly stretching out his long bony finger. All prophets have long bony fingers. I see him stretching out his long bony index finger toward the king just before he thunders, "You are the man." Can you imagine? "You took the ewe." Took a ewe lamb from him. You get that? "You took the ewe." And suddenly, the truth cold cocks David in the jaw. It hits him. "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I also would have given you much more. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon."
Thanks, Pastor Sandy, for sharing again with us from the book of 2 Samuel. We are so glad all of you have joined us today for Sandy Adams Radio. The story of King David teaches us that a heart of faith is deeply pleasing to God. When God looks into your heart, what is it that he sees there? Like David, we can ask God to search us and reveal the state of our heart to us. And like David, when he brings to mind anything that is outside his will, we can turn and follow God again. If you'd like someone to pray with you, call us at 770-736-2828. Once again, that number is 770-736-2828. Let us know your prayer requests or your praises. We'd love to rejoice with you too. If you live in or around Atlanta, Georgia, we'd like to invite you to Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain for our weekend services. You can find out all about the church, including directions and service times, at our website, sandyadams.org. Also, there you can find recordings of today's message and many other studies in the Word. We'd love to have you partner with us in ministry through prayer, and if the Lord leads, financially. We've set up a secure online page under Donate on sandyadams.org, where you can find more information. That's all we have time for today. Be sure to join us next time to hear more from the book of 2 Samuel with Pastor Sandy Adams.